Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to another episode of So Married a Horror Fan. I am Simon.
I'm Lee.
And it is week two in May as we are looking at our horror films from a different perspective month. Thank you to everyone who bared with us while we had some issues with previous episodes and listened to our episode on High Rise. We appreciate it. Our High Rise episode was out last week. This week, we are looking for episode number 169. At the 2010 film by Darren Aronofsky, Black Swan, which I am very excited about.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you want to give us a rundown?
So, Simon's already started stealing parts of my bit, so fuck you. Black Swan from 2010, directed by Darren Aronofsky, as Simon has already said. Also, I feel like I pronounced his name wrong.
No, really good job. What did you say?
Darren Aronofsky.
That is it. That is how you say my man's name.
Solid.
Say his name, say his name.
Written by Mark Heyman, Andreas Hines, John J. McLaughlin. Sorry, Andreas Hines on there twice, so I was about to say his name again. I was like, no, I already said that. Just the three writers. Good job, gang. Casting-wise for this film, we have got Natalie Portman as Nina Sayers slash the Swan Queen, Mila Kunitz as Lily slash the Black Swan. I realise they've also got the part names as well for who they would be in regards to the play.
The actual thing.
Vincent Cassell as Thomas Leroy or the Gentleman.
Tomar. It's pronounced Tomar.
Fine. Barbara Hershey as Erica Sawyers slash the Queen. Winona Ryder as Beth McIntyre slash the Dying Swan. Benjamin Millipede. Great. As David slash the Prince. I think a lot of these are just the main dancers, we'll say. So I've got Christina Solo as Veronica or Little Swan, Christina Appano as Galina, Little Swan, and Janet Montgomery as Madeline, Little Swan, which is the little clique of girls.
Yes.
We then have Sebastian Stan as Andrew the suitor and Toby Hemingway as Tom the suitor.
So does that mean he's Jerry then, Stan? Because she says that they're called Tom and Jerry.
Yes.
he's a little mouse bitch.
Yeah. We have a lot of other cast members, but realistically, they're not that involved in the rest of the film, so we're not going to bother. Otherwise, I'll be here for ages because this cast is very big. Plotline-wise for this film, Nina is a ballerina in New York City. Nina is a ballerina in a New York City ballet company whose life, like all those in her profession, is completely consumed with dance. She lives with her obsessive former ballerina mother, Erica, who exerts a suffocating control over her. When artistic director Tomas Leroy decides to replace prima ballerina Beth McIntyre for an opening production of the new season, Nina is first choice, but Nina has competition, a new dancer, Lily, who impresses Leroy as well. Swan Lake requires a dancer who can play both white Swan with the innocence and grace, and Black Swan, who represents guile and sensuality. Nina fits the white swan perfectly, but Lily is the perfection of the personification of Black Swan. As the two young dancers expand their rivalry into a twisted friendship, Nina begins to get more in touch with her dark side, a recklessness that threatens to destroy her. That was a long plot storyline there, guys. Thanks, Fox, for making that long. Let's see if we've got figures. We do. So it was made on a budget of $13 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it made, are you ready for this? $329 million. I'm not gonna do all the little bits.
Yeah.
$329 million. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he did really fucking well.
Yeah, I have a funny story about that actually in a minute when we get into
it. Okay. Good job. Well, that's me done basically.
Can you give me the keys to the Letterboxd Lounge.
Can I go to the Letterboxd Lounge? I can. Indeed. Letterboxd.
Yo, Letterboxd, if you want to sponsor us.
I watched Cancel.
Well, you technically did watch it.
No, but I don't log it on here, do I?
I mean.
Black Swan.
Plie?
Here we go. There's all the.
Here we go. So, I love how, like, most of the things have got fucking spoilers on them. I'm just going to do. So there's one here, 5 stars from Holly. The feminine urge to go completely insane. Sophie, 4.5 stars. chuckles nervously. What the fuck? Ivy Walk, 4.5 stars. Not kidding. I am so close to becoming this. Alor, 4.5 stars. I'm never looking into a mirror ever again. And then the last one, Fran, 4 stars. I got so stressed watching this that a bunch of M&Ms melted in my hand and I thought it was my blood. And it has an average score on Letterboxd of 4.1. At the time when it came out, it was one of only 5 horror films in history to be nominated for an Oscar.
Hmm.
And it's only one of, I think, a couple that have won, won Oscars.
Interestingly, is a lot of people can say it's one of the only horror movies to ever win an Oscar. This film is classed as a drama thriller. It's mm-hmm. not classed as a horror film.
Yeah.
It won awards, so they wouldn't dare call it a horror film because they'd have to admit they were giving horror films awards.
Well, this is the thing that makes me laugh, because on Disney Plus, it's in the horror section, but then when you pull the synopsis up, it calls it a psychological thriller.
Yep.
Darren Aronofsky has always maintained that even though it wasn't marketed as such, he's always maintained that it is a psychological horror film, which I think is probably the best description for it. Mm. But this film came out in January 2011 in the UK, a couple of months after it had already come out in America. My 2 favourite film-going experiences of the year 2011 are this...
Mm-hmm.
And Gone Girl. Not Gone Girl. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Both for exactly the same reason. So this... Do you know the reason? Part of the reason why this movie made so much money? I'm about to tell you now. When I went to see this movie, I arrived for my screening of it early. And I was queuing up outside the screen. And there were a bunch of old people coming out. And they all looked like they'd fucking seen ghosts. And when I was in my screening... 3 people who were elderly walked out. People went to go and see this movie because they thought that it was about Swan Lake, not realising what the film was about. And yeah, it was one of my favourite cinema going experiences, watching all these like fucking old Guardian and Telegraph readers who were like, oh yes, we love the theatre. Oh, we're going to the ballet in the summer. Oh, yes. Watching this movie and being like, what the actual... And it's the same with Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Because that book had so much, like, hype around it, people went to the film not knowing what the story was about. And then, yeah, a lot of people are just sitting there going, what's happening? So, yeah, I think a lot of people, because it wasn't marketed as a horror movie and a lot of the ballet stuff is in the trailer... A lot of people thought it was a proper dramatization or a film version of Swan Lake. So they stumped up the money to go and see it and then ended up leaving the fucking cinema absolutely horrified.
Hmm.
Which I think is fucking hilarious. But yeah, this is the only Darren Aronofsky film you've seen, right? Because you've never seen Requiem for a Dream, Noah, The Fountain, yeah. The Wrestler, or Mother!
Mother! Yeah, we'll go with yes. Yeah. I think it's the Aronofsky film I've seen.
I'll start with you because I feel like you're going to be a lot more negative about this film mm-hmm. than what I am. Talk me through your thoughts and feelings on Black Swan.
I really want to like this film. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to like it the first time I've seen it. I really wanted to like it this time. I don't find Natalie Portman convincing at all.
Okay.
I do as Nina in the beginning when she's all innocent and doe-eyed and terrified of everything. The further you get into the movie and more it explores her psyche and her slow decline into madness, I stop believing the film because I don't think, and this is really horrible, Natalie Portman is a good enough actress to pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, if they switched and had Mila Kunis in the main role, I think I'd have the same problem of I'd struggle to find her in the first half of the film believable, but I'd find the second half more believable.
Yeah,
because it's a really difficult role to cast, and that is true. You need somebody who can do both, and I do feel like it's difficult to find an actress who can do both.
Mm-hmm.
Winona Ryder could have done both
mm-hmm.
because she's fucking Winona Ryder.
She has, despite her prominent billing, she has 4 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, she's very rarely in this film, which is really disappointing because I think Winona Ryder is an amazing actress. But yeah, I just don't find that. I think that's some of my biggest problem. I don't like body horror anyway, so a lot of the scenes in this do make my my stomach like actually twist. Mm-hmm. But I don't find Natalie Portman believable. Mm-hmm. If you put her in a role where she's the innocent ingenue, completely believe it.
Yeah.
She's very believable because she's very doe-like. Mm-hmm. But the minute she has to start being more twisted and dark, I'm like, you know, you've lost me because I just can't believe it from you at all. You're not convincing. But outside of her, I do think the rest of the cast are very good. I think it's beautifully shot. Because it is a stunningly shot film. It's beautiful. But the failure of the main actress really does this film a huge disservice and makes the entire film kind of lower in expectation very quickly for me.
I think she won an Oscar for this, or was nominated for an Oscar for this. I find this movie to be absolutely fascinating. Like, Darren Aronofsky is one of those filmmakers I got into when I was quite young. I watched Requiem for a Dream when I was a teenager, and that movie, like, really, really, really fucked me up. It's a really hard-going film. Mm. But he's one of those, like, directors, like, I have absolutely no interest in ballet whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I went to go and see this movie opening weekend purely because he directed it. Mm-hmm. And, like, I would follow that man down any fucking rabbit hole, because I just think that he's such a perfect, he's a filmmaker's filmmaker, if that makes sense. I agree with a lot of what you said with regards to Natalie Portman. I think there are some incredible scenes in this movie. I think the fact that, like, I think her performance is very, very uncomfortable in this, because of, like, the amount of weight that she lost and the fact that she is basically playing somebody who is infantilized and sexualized at the same time in this film. And I'm also kind of like, I said to you when we were watching it, I was like, is it that she's not a good actress, or is it just that the film is so well written and so well directed that they kind of just direct around her, but they kind of just give her a lot of scenes that are very similar. Like, she plays a lot of very similar scenes in this. And I'm not really sure what the answer is. I think there's probably an answer somewhere in the middle of it's her limitations as an actress, but then also the limitations of the part and the role and things like that. But I do think there are some scenes in this where I find it hard to take my eyes off of her. But I think that's because of what she's being asked to do in the character is so, like, uncomfortable that you're just a bit like, I want to look away, but I can't, because
the only scene in this film where I was actually, like, mesmerised by her performance, and this was really weird because it is a scene where she's the black swan, mm-hmm. is the final performance at the end, mm-hmm. when she becomes the black swan.
Yeah.
That sequence from her arriving at the stage side after stabbing somebody,
Well, she stabs herself.
Yeah, no, I know that. Mm. But obviously in the film, it looks she stabbed Mila Kunis. Yeah. In fact, she stabs herself. So from that moment, when she arrives at the start side of the stage and she's like twisting her neck and her body starts contorting slightly, up until the end of that dance is the only time that she honestly mesmerised me throughout the entire film. And I do feel part of that is because the dance of the Black Swan is a very impressive dance.
It's very captivating. Natalie Portman actually spent a year learning how to dance in preparation for this movie, and she paid for all of it, for the most part, out of her own pocket until the film got funding, which I think is commendable. She also gave up her trailer to get an on-set medic for this film.
Well, she didn't give up her trailer.
Wow.
They told her that she couldn't have a medic because they didn't have the budget for it.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm sure we can make some cut so I can have a medic. And they took her trailer away.
Well, the way I saw it worded was that she said, you can take my trailer away.
Oh, that's not how I read the story. It didn't say that in my one. It basically said,
Did you read the IMDb article?
Yeah, because it doesn't say you can take my trailer.
Oh, I was sure that was how it was worded, but I could be wrong.
Where is it? So I definitely read it.
Yeah, I knew that there was something where her trailer was taken away, but I possibly read it wrong. I read it as that she suggested that she would sacrifice.
Yeah, so she stated that they needed to cut items from the budget. Oh, and they could take her trailer away.
Yeah.
to hire a medic. Okay.
Because she kept having an issue with her toes.
The portmanteau.
Yeah. Which is a portmanteau is like a thing, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, I don't know what it is.
But I don't really know.
When I read it, I was like, that's how I read it in my head.
Yeah, portmanteau.
But yeah, I just, yeah. Like, there are some really cringy stuff in this. Like, toe and finger stuff. Like, rib stuff. Like, it's a very uncomfortable film to watch if you're... But, like, The Fly was a big influence on it. Like, the transformation of Seth Brundle was a big influence on the body horror, which I find really interesting. I think the problem with this film is... Now, as somebody who loves Darren Aronofsky, and I think Darren Aronofsky's work is very obscure and very obtuse, he's always somebody that deals in, like, layers and metaphors. Like, his films are never just about drug addiction or, like, a washed-up wrestler, etc. I find that this movie is saying a lot, but in doing so much, it never actually says as much as it should do. Because this film very clearly is obviously using Black Swan as a metaphor for so many other things. Like, if this movie came out today, this would be A24's wet fucking dream.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they would absolutely shit their pants over like the amount of things that this movie is using metaphors for. Because at its core, this movie is about, like, identity and paranoia and ambition. And it's also about, like, the way that we, like, look at art and performance and the people behind the performance. It's about the destruction of innocence. It's about, like, power dynamics. It's about, like, the way that, like, certain arts infantilize women but then also sexualize women from a young age. And then obviously once they've reached a certain age, they've basically, like, outlived their usefulness. Like, there's obviously many, many different ways that you can interpret her relationship with her mother. Some of them are more disgusting than others. And it's a lot of really, like, the movie's, like, there's points where you're watching this movie where it almost feels like Darren Aronofsky's, like, stood behind your shoulder going, do you get it? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? And I'm like, yes, bro, I get it. Like, I know what you're... But there's sometimes where he, like, the whole thing of, like, she sees her face in everything that she sees as, like, a threat to her.
Well, so this is the thing, and I think this is the main central premise of the film, is the film is about striving for perfection.
Yeah.
So Nina is consistently striving to be perfect.
Yeah.
She wants to be perfect. And then we introduce Lily into the thing. Lily is Nina. So Lily and Nina are the same person. Yeah. But Lily is Nina if Nina didn't have the overbearing mother.
Yeah, if she was the more other free, roads traveled.
She was less obsessed with being perfect and more obsessed with loving what she does and enjoying what she does. And that is why Nina is such a threat to Lily. No, that's why Lily is such a threat to Nina. Because Lily represents everything that Nina could be if she just let go.
Yeah.
And that is why they kind of are the two halves of the swan. Because Nina is the black... Nina is the white swan. Nina is the perfect, innocent, pretty little thing who's never done anything wrong. She's always perfect and pristine. Nina is the darker side of it, who gives in to her lust and her enjoyment of life and yet still manages to be amazing at what she does because she's living life to the fullest. She's not holding herself back. She's never saying, oh, well, I can't eat that. Like, there's literally a scene where they go to where they get food and Nina's like, I'll have a burger and chips. And Lily's like, I'll have a burger and chips. Fuck everything else. Whereas it is implied throughout this that Nina has an eating disorder.
Alongside many other potential mental
illnesses. Alongside a lot of other shit. The girl is broken in so many ways.
And also, if what Lee is saying isn't obvious enough, Darren Aronofsky will go out of his way to, at least four scenes in this movie, to show Mila Kunis transforming into, like, Natalie Portman. Like, she'll see her somewhere,
yeah,
and it'll be her face, and then she'll turn into Lily. Just so you, as a simpleton audience viewer, fully understands
that Nina is Lily.
Yeah, he does.
And Lily is Nina.
He also does it with Beth as well. There's a couple of scenes where Beth transforms into,
because Beth is the view, is what Nina views as perfect.
Yeah.
She's pristine.
But then as she starts to...
She's always been, you know, the main ballet dancer. But she's not. Beth is not perfect.
Yeah.
Which we get implied from the very beginning. When it's heavily implied straight away that she's been banging Vincent Cassell.
Yeah.
Thomas. basically to get roles.
And then her view of her changes, because no longer is she like this artist on a pedestal. As Nina starts to lose her mind more, she becomes a vision of the future.
Yeah.
She's like, that's what I'm going to be when I've outlived my usefulness, when he moves on to somebody younger and prettier that he can, like, fucking gaslight and manipulate and sexually assault and whatever the fuck it is else that he's doing. Yeah. Like a cunt.
Yeah. I do have to say, this film does nothing good for ballet, though, whatsoever. Mm. It really gives you this really dark look into what life as a ballet dancer is like. Which, to me, I feel like is a little bit disrespectful, because ballet is not, as far as I'm aware, and as far as, like, reading interviews with actual ballet dancers, this isn't what ballet is like.
Yeah.
Like, it's tough and it's hardcore and you live for dancing. Like, that's all you really do with your time, because you have to be at the top of your game. But they're not banging artistic directors for roles.
I mean,
they're not banging fucking potential people who give the theatre company money.
Yeah.
They're not sabotaging each other. Like, don't get me wrong, it'll be, it's clicky, it's like high school, like, on steroids, but
I'm sure that stuff has happened in the history of the medium. Like, it happens probably everywhere, unfortunately, but it's not as...
You're not, like, a big company like that, it wouldn't happen in.
Yeah.
Like, because it'd be very difficult to cover up.
Mm.
And B, this is going to sound really weird, for a ballet dancer, that's a risk of getting pregnant.
Yeah.
And that kills your career.
As we find out. As Barbara Hershey keeps beating us over the head with.
Yeah. Like, it would ruin your career. Because you can't dance while you're pregnant.
Yeah.
And then you've got to take, not 9 months of pregnancy, but about 5 months of your pregnancy out. Then the recovery time afterwards, depending on where you live, that can take quite a long time as well. Like, America recovery is way worse than the UK, because we can stay in a hospital if we need to.
Yeah.
So you're looking at another year or two recovery time, potentially. And at that point, you won't have been dancing.
Yeah. And then you have to, like, relearn.
And you have to relearn everything, rebuild the mushrooms.
Break your feet back in.
Smash your feet back to pieces. Mm. So, yeah, like, that's
rebuild
it.
Rebuild the mushrooms?
Rebuild the muscles.
Oh, I thought you said muscles.
Like, rebuild your mushrooms. I mean, I might have said mushrooms, but I'm pretty sure I said muscles.
Like, what the fuck?
But I do have to give it. Aronofsky, weirdly enough, did do a decent... I don't know if anyone's ever seen videos of how ballet dancers break their shoes in, because point shoes are fucking expensive, first and foremost. But they are rock solid when you get them.
Yeah.
And you can't dance in those. So you will pay through the nose for these very expensive shoes, and then immediately tear the soles out, rip the insides out, crack them, smash them, they hit them against stuff. They pull the lace, so basically when you've got ballet shoes, there's like a lace bit that runs through the whole thing, it's like elasticated. So you'll, like, basically tie those to the size of your feet, cut them off, burn them. Like, you, like, bad ballet shoes get destroyed the second you buy them to do ballet. We will destroy them. Like, you have to restitch them, stitch your ribbons in as well to go up your legs, things like that. And it's the one thing I will give Aronofsky about this film, is he did a really good job of showing the kind of damage they will immediately do to ballet shoes, which is really fun. I don't know why, I just find great joy watching someone destroy a pair of ballet shoes. But I also find it insane that you will pay $500-$600 for this pristine pair of shoes that you immediately have to destroy. Like, what the fuck? And they don't last that long.
No.
They also show you Natalie Portman binding her feet at one point as well, like putting the like tape around her toes and stuff. Again, an actual thing ballet dancers do, because you wreck your feet. I watched ballet as a kid, if that is not obvious to you all. I did want to do ballet as a child, but I was a chubby child.
I have a friend who does, like, competitive dancing. A friend of mine who you've met. And Claire.
Irish dance, right?
Yeah.
Tap.
And, yeah, all of that sort of
all
stuff.
All of that.
And she talks about how fucking, like, mental it is. Like, I've, you know, I speak to her fairly frequently, and I've spoke to her when she's preparing for competitions and stuff, and she's talking about, like, I spoke to her recently, and she was talking about, like, being in rehab and stuff, and how hard it is to, like, come back when you're rehabbing, and the time that you miss, and
the
all that.
The broken, like...
Yeah, like, knee injuries, feet injuries,
you weren't
ankles.
Clear on what kind of rehab this was.
Sorry, not...
Rehabilitation for, like...
Yeah.
Because she's, she's like broke her ankles or like broke her toes and stuff like that. And she's like, it's mentally taxing. Like, it's really fucking like,
because you can't dance.
Yeah, you can't dance. You can't do anything. And she's like, and I think for a lot of people, especially, and like this film drives this point home to like the nth degree. I don't think it's, if you're anybody in like a competitive sport, in like a dance troupe, anything like that, it's not so much the injury that's the problem. It's the psychological effects of being on the sidelines and watching everybody else like improve while you can't do anything. Because you could be like, take a tennis player, you could be like a number one ranked tennis player in the world. You break your elbow, you have to be away for a year. There's like 10 other guys out there that are going to take that fucking spot.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not. And like, I think after the injury, like, from having talked to people who have suffered injuries and things, you're never the same again. There's always that, like, that thing in the back of your head that's like, it's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen again. Like, you always are a little bit more cautious. You're always a little bit, you're never the same performer again. And I think that's one of the things that they highlight in this movie. Like, they talk about, especially through the way, like, they view the relationship with her mother, because her mother's like, her mother's basically made her an avatar for the life that she couldn't live anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the reason why Nina is kept so childlike. Like, she keeps her so childlike because she doesn't want her to go out and meet people or risk getting pregnant or risk throwing away this thing, because my dream is now your dream.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we see that in so many movies, like the hockey player who was like an NHL like Stanley Cup winner, who's like, son, will be like, you will be everything that I couldn't be, and all that sort of shit.
High School Musical.
Yeah, yeah, like Troy Bolton's dad. Fuck you, Coach Bolton.
Someone did the maths. Like, he had Troy really quite young as well. So they were like, that really thing, he had to give everything up to raise a son and a family.
Yeah, and he's basically a teen dad, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone did the maths. I've seen the, like, someone did the maths of how old Coach Bolton would have been when he had Troy.
Because there's a tense conversation between Nina and her mum where she's like, I gave up you. And she's like, yeah, but you were 28. And, like, Nina basically implies that she was at the end of her career because she was, like, nearing 30 anyway. So she's she's like, you wouldn't have got much further even if you hadn't had me. How do you feel about the relationship between her and her mum in this film? Because I think it's so, it reminds me a lot of the relationship that Carrie has with her mum in Carrie. Like, she doesn't want this child to grow up and to have a life. Like, she wants her to be like the only person in the world that she can rely on, because, you know, I'm gonna succeed in my dreams one way or another, like, and you are gonna be the thing that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I find their relationship to be so complicated and to be so, like, you're never really sure whether she actually does give a shit about her or not. And there are so many scenes in this where she's, like, you know, talking about how perfect she is and, like, you know, the scratches on her back and all this sort of stuff. And the way that she treats her is just very much like a child. And it's like, you know, she still tucks her in at night. She still tries to dress her. She still tries to, like, control every aspect of her life. Yeah. And I'm like, is that because you're trying to gain control over something because you couldn't control your own life? Like, there's so many different ways you can interpret it. But I'm interested to see how you view that relationship.
I mean, to be fair, I didn't give it much thought, to be honest. I was just like, oh, her mum wants her to basically do what she couldn't do. And it's a cunt about her.
Yeah. Barbara Hershey's fucking great in this.
She is. But you are right. Like, at 28... See, interestingly enough, so ballet kind of 30s to 40 is kind of where your career begins to, like,
simmer down.
Simmer down. But, realistically, if you haven't had injuries, you can carry on dancing. Like, there's nothing stop you being a ballet dancer at, like, 60. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Apart from getting roles.
Yeah.
Like, but average career is, like, by the time you hit 30, 40, you might push a little bit past that. But,
and you've started at what age?
Well, it depends. It realistically depends on so many factors. Like, you could get scouted at 16.
Mm.
You could also not get noticed until you're, like, 25, 30 already.
But what I'm saying is you start, like, training ballet, like, what, 3-4 years
old?
Oh,
yeah, you start training ballet when you are very young.
Yeah.
Like, it is, you have to be very passionate about ballet to become a ballet dancer and then make a career out of it. It's not just something you can start picking up and being like, oh, I'm going to be a ballet dancer. Like, I couldn't turn around where I'm like, I'm going to go become a ballet dancer. You have to train, and it's a long process. Because
I find it mental, looking at, like, how stressful all of the ballet scenes are in this. Like, and I don't know how, like, fictional and how true some of the stuff in this is, obviously having never been to a fucking ballet class in my life. But, like, it is mental when you see, like, the stresses and the pressure that they put themselves through in this film, to think that, like, somebody at the age of, like, 3 or 4 has decided to enter into this career knowing that that's what they're going to be subjected to from such
a... I mean, you don't know...
Like, you don't know that, but, like, but in hindsight, when you think about the journey that they would go on from that young age to where they are...
But also, the thing is you don't become a ballet dancer by accident.
No, of course.
Like, you have to be passionate. Because it's not just that, like, it's a lot of stress and stuff once you are a professional ballet dancer. It's a lot of hours and a lot of time and effort. It's a lot of stress even training to become a ballet dancer. Like, some ballet classes are super fucking strict. Like, very, very, very strict. Even on, like, toddlers.
Yeah.
You have more that are, like, fun, but, like, some of them are super strict from the get-go. Yeah. Like,
and
if
dance
you are
moms
here,
are crazy.
You want to be a ballet dancer, and we are treating you like that from the get-go.
Yeah.
Like, so you kind of know what you're letting yourself in for, but I do feel like it's, like, anything, though. It's any kind of job where you are in direct competition with your friends, your colleagues, like, day in, day out.
Mm.
It's the exact same kind of situation, because you are in direct competition. Like, your best friend could be in the same troop as you.
Mm.
You are in direct competition with that person.
Yeah, which is not pleasant.
No.
This is a horror film, though, right? Like, let's get to the point. This is a 100%. This movie is a fucking nightmare, right? Yeah. It's a very... And I'd forgotten, having not seen it for such a long time, how nightmarish this film actually is. Mm-hmm. Because, and it's not even anything to do with, like, excessive gore or anything that's particularly frightening. I think it's, like, it does kind of like that thing that David Lynch does, where you watch somebody, like, slowly deteriorate and go crazy, and, like, it's that paranoia and that simmering tension. Like, I don't think that Nina and Laura Palmer are too dissimilar as characters in some senses. And I think, like, when you view it through, like, the Lynch lens of, like, taking something that would be considered, like, perfect and then contorting it in a way that makes it less than perfect and, like, destroying it. Like, there are so many scenes in this where you're just like, I feel uncomfortable. Like, I don't want to see this character go through this anymore. And, like, one of the big things when you Google this movie is somebody asked the question of, like, what mental illness does Nina have? And somebody basically implied that she had OCD. And I was like, I think it's more complicated than that.
I wouldn't say she has OCD. The problem I have with people ever saying that is you are not a therapist.
Yeah.
Like, you can't armchair diagnose a character in a film. Yeah. I'm not being funny. In reality, it's probably closer to something like schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But I'm
or
not
BPD,
a therapist.
Maybe.
Or BPD, yeah, I guess. But it's like they're hearing voices and stuff is very much linked with, like, things like schizophrenia. But, I mean, if we're not a fucking therapist, you know? I mean, also, we don't get to see enough of the character to even try and make a diagnosis.
Yeah.
So I always think it's quite dangerous to say, oh, yeah, that character is so clearly schizophrenic.
I also...
Because it sets a precedent of, like, oh, that's what schizophrenic people are like.
Yeah.
No.
I also, if I could be so bold, and maybe to say something controversial, I do not believe that the character in the film suffers from any mental illness.
I feel like it's stress-induced paranoia, if anything.
Yeah, I believe that there are certain scenes in this movie where what she is seeing and what she is experiencing are distortions based on whoever she's interacting with at the time. She is experiencing the reality that they want her to experience. So rather than her, because she is so childlike and she has that stunted development, she is experiencing whatever in that scene
it is a form of gaslighting. So she gets from the scene whatever the person is projecting onto her rather than experiencing it for herself.
I mean, maybe. I don't fucking know. I feel like the problem is all both the writers of this film, Aaron and Aronofsky, think they're way smarter than they actually are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this is so ingenious. Like, it's definitely going to give that feeling of, like, we really know what we're talking about. And you're like, bruv, yeah, you shit. Fucking hell. But I do feel like with any film like this, which I personally would find quite pretentious, is that I always feel a little bit coming out of it, like, the writer, the director, the producer are like, oh my God, we're so smart. Like, the general public just aren't going to get this because they're so dim and they're not educated. And I'm like, or alternatively, you're just cunts. But I do feel, because I haven't watched a lot of Aronofsky stuff, this is the only Aronofsky thing I've seen, but everything I've ever heard about Aronofsky is it does give off big vibes of like, oh my God, look how smart I am. No, bruv?
Yeah, he is somebody who deals in like vagaries rather than absolutes, and I do like that sometimes with his work. Like, I do agree sometimes his work could just be like, no, just be straightforward with me, whereas sometimes I do like things being left open to interpretation, like especially the end of the film, like him and Natalie Portman have both like interpreted the film in different ways. Like, she obviously, the stab wound that she dies from is obviously the stab wound where she stabbed herself, where it's made to look like she stabbed Lily. And obviously she said, I don't want the blood to come from that area because it looks like I'm having a period. But he was like, but that's kind of like the point. Like, and they both kind of have come to the conclusion that she has to die at the end. Like, Nina has to die. That childlike person has to die in order for her to become a woman. And it, like, that final scene is about her claiming her womanhood and finally killing the child inside
of her. Realistically is complete and utter fucking bullshit from both of them. Because the closing line from Nina is, I was perfect.
Yeah.
And the reality of the situation is that Nina can never be perfect ever again. Because she has gone so far into her own darkness that she has lost that perfection. She is no longer that perfect, innocent ingenue. Therefore, in order for her to maintain that perfection, the only way for her to carry on being perfect going forward is to have one final perfect performance and then die.
Yeah.
Because perfection doesn't exist in our world.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as
perfect. It's the Kurt Cobain theory.
Yeah. But her final line feeds into that of like, the only way for this to end is for her to die because perfection does not exist. And she has gone so far into the darkness now, she can never be perfect again.
Yeah.
She can never be that perfect ballerina figure in a glass case because the case is smashed. Yeah.
And they even do that when she has the scene in her bedroom where she pulls the feathers out and her legs contort and she hits her head on the bed. As she hits her head on the bed and the screen cuts to black, you see the music box with the broken ballerina that's got no head and it's got one leg missing. And that, again, is Aronofsky's way of like, look, guys, the ballerina is broken. See what I'm doing?
To then have Aronofsky sit there and go, oh, the reason it ends like that is because she has to die to become a woman. That's not what you tell us in the film.
Well, that's what Natalie Portman said as well. Like,
they're both speaking. But the thing is that is not what they tell us in the film.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't bleed from there because it looks like I'm on my period. No, it doesn't. You are bleeding from your stomach.
Yeah.
I don't know if I had to break this to both of you, but blood comes from your vagina.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not low enough. If her skirt had started turning red, I could kind of get on board.
Yeah.
But it's not. She is stabbed in her stomach.
Yeah. And it's very
which,
obvious.
Which, as a woman, as an adult woman, to me, reads more of her killing off her adult self, because the wound would have gone through her womb and her, like, her reproductive organs, which, reading it from like a whatever point of view, would be more of her, the idea of her killing her chance of becoming an adult.
Yeah,
because she's removing the her adult organs, like the things that, you know, cause a lot of our fucking issues.
Like, symbolise womanhood.
And yeah, like, it symbolises womanhood, and she's destroying that part of herself by stabbing herself in the stomach, which therefore destroys the idea of becoming a woman and potentially a mother in future. Like, becoming, like, moving into adulthood. And I'm not saying to be an adult you have to have kids. Trust me, that's fucking bullshit. But, like, symbolically, the destroying of the womb is the destruction of the idea of womanhood and motherhood and becoming an adult.
Yeah, especially in, like, a patriarchal society.
Exactly.
Where women are viewed
so
by
I'm
what they
like,
can provide
the
rather
way,
than who they are.
The way where you have placed that wound on her body does not feed in to the bullshit you're then trying to feed us after the fact. Because that, to me, does not read of this as the destruction of innocence. It reads as the destruction of adulthood and the refusal to become anything more than you already are.
Yeah. I mean, I've never really... It's one of those films where I walked away from it going, I don't really need anyone to explain the ending to me. I was like, the film ends... I feel like the film ends in the only way the film can end. Like, you know what I mean? Like... Whether she dies for X, Y, or Z reason, I feel like the film only ever ends with her dying. Like, there's no version of this story where she stays alive and she ends up becoming a Beth character.
But this is the thing, is because, and again, we were talking about the destruction of innocence and stuff like that. In the ballet, the white swan kills herself.
Yeah. I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who fell in love with a prince. No, who turned into a swan. But then her prince fell for the wrong girl and she kills herself.
Yeah. But so in the story of Swan Lake, which this the framing of the film kind of follows the premise of.
Yeah. It's a very dark
ballet
version. Yeah.
I mean, the ballet Swan Lake is fucking dark.
Yeah.
Anyway. But the white swan is the one who dies. Which is why, going into it, you know her character has to die because she is the white swan. Mm-hmm. Lily is the black swan.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's trying to say as well, it's like that duality doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot be both. You are one or the other. And trying to be both will destroy you.
And I think...
Which, again, is a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
Because you can have that duality as a person.
And I think that's why the scene with her and Lily, where she thinks that she stabbed Lily and she turns into the black swan before she goes on stage, is such a confusing part of the ending of the film. Because it's almost like Nina's preempting her change and trying to, like, kill the black swan inside of herself before it ever appears.
Yeah.
I'm like, in doing that...
You become the black swan.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of like... That's the part of the film where I'm a bit like, that to me, that sequence and then that feeding into the end is where this film does disappear up its own arse a little bit. Because obviously, like, you know, we spend the whole film talking about, like, duality and, like, the darkness of man and, you know, inside of us there are two wolves and all this fucking bullshit. And that real pop psychology stuff that tends to be really surface level in a lot of Aronofsky films. But that sequence where she thinks that she's killed Lily... She becomes everything that she feared that she would become.
Mm-hmm.
And they foreshadow that at the beginning where, like, Vincent Cassell's character, Tomar, says, you know, you have to surprise yourself and surprise the audience. Like, you have to, like, let go. So they foreshadow it way, way, way early in the film. But it doesn't make any sense for her to preemptively kill the other part and then turn into it, especially when they reframe it as... She's killing the child inside of her in order for her to become an adult. I'm like, all of that explanation
again,
is very...
That doesn't,
like,
make sense.
Yeah,
because,
none of it.
Because the ending kicks off really realistically with the murder of Lily.
Yeah, or who we think is Lily.
Or who we think is Lily.
Yeah.
Is... So that scene to me reads as Nina is trying to kill off the darker parts of herself.
Yeah.
To maintain her perfection.
Yeah.
But in doing so, she breaks that perfection. Because you cannot kill off your darker parts. All that does is makes it worse, realistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it can also be read as innocence trying to kill off adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, kills both.
Yeah.
Because you can't maintain being a child forever.
Yeah.
You can't maintain being an innocent forever. There will always become a day where you become an adult.
Yeah.
When that innocence gets broken. Again, the problem is that what the film is saying and what the film is showing us is in direct opposite to what Aronofsky then went on to say about the film. I feel like Aronofsky and this is talking as someone who's only seen the film and I've not been in Aronofsky's brain, but I do feel like he had something he wanted to say, failed to say it,
and then tried to retcon it afterwards.
And I'm like, none of what you're saying to me feeds into the imagery you're giving me in the film. Yeah.
And I think even if you look at it from a psychological standpoint, if you look at it as a trauma victim who's trying to, like, regain control of their lives and regain control, like, get some, what's the word I'm trying to look for? The word when we talk about people being in control of their bodies, control, autonomy. Even if they're trying to, like, gain some kind of, like, mental autonomy in the form of all this abuse that all these people have put themselves through, by doing something to kind of erase that trauma and embrace that and be like, this is me finally embracing that these things have created this darkness inside of me that I know is never going to go away. But this is me choosing to face the things that have created this person that I have become. Even looking at it from that lens, it doesn't make any fucking sense.
And this is the other major problem with the ending of the film, is that they'll say, oh, it's because she accepted all of herself and chose to die. In Swan Lake, when the White Swan chooses to kill herself, she accepts everything.
Mm-hmm.
She is in full acceptance and she is prepared to kill herself.
Yeah, it's not suicide for suicide's sake.
It's she's given all she can and she's got nothing left and she kills herself with that acceptance. When Nina throws herself at the end of the film, she is not ready to do that. You can see it in her face. And I don't know if part of that is that Natalie Portman cannot portray that level of emotion. Yeah. But the way she looks at everyone, she's got tears in her eyes, she looks scared.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, so what you're feeding us, again, is entirely counteracted by the performance being given. Because she doesn't look like she's accepting it. Yeah. She looks terrified of what is about to happen. And then once she's on the floor and she's dying, then she gives us acceptance. And I'm like, that acceptance should have happened.
At the beginning,
when you were about to throw yourself from the cliff. And it doesn't. Yeah. And again, that takes away from the end of this film because you're feeding us something and showing us something different. Yeah.
And it's like the thing is as well, that you can read that look on her face of fear, like, many different ways. Is it fear of what she's about to do? Is it a fear of the fact that she's about to kill herself in front of this audience and this is going to be her last act? And even in death, she wants to be perfect. She wants to be seen as going out in a perfect way. Is it the fear of, because again, this is another thing that Aronofsky feeds us through the film that never gets resolved. Like, we are told that Beth throws herself in front of a car. Does she, or was she pushed by Vincent Cassell after she confronts him at the party? Was she set up to be killed? Like, we find out that Lily's obviously the one that's been trying to, like, poison her. Like, was Lily involved in obviously trying to off Beth as well? And is it that fear of, like, if I stay around, am I going to become like Beth? Am I going to become someone that's thrown to the wolves and set up to die? Or the other side, am I going to be someone that's complicit in destroying other people that are going to try and follow my path? So what is the mindset when she's killing herself?
Exactly. Also, with Lily, I wouldn't say she's been poisoning her.
No, I mean, like, when she put the thing in her drink is what I meant to say.
Well, no, she doesn't put anything in her drink. She gives her the pill.
Well, yeah, but that's what, like that's what I mean. Like, she gave her the pill knowing that it would knock her out, so she would probably not be in her best state the next day, so she could take her role.
No. We only see Lily through Nina's eyes. The only time we see Lily truly is at the end of the film when she goes to the room and she's like, you were amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You were so good. And I'm sorry, like, you know, I never wanted to take your part. Like, you were late and it, like, that's the only time we truly see Lily.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else we see
is a construct.
Is a construct through Nina's mind. Yeah. She views Lily as her own enemy, and therefore that's how we see Lily throughout the film. But that is not Lily's character. That is not who Lily truly is. We don't see Lily until the end of the film, when Nina already thinks she's killed her. That's the only, as for me watching the film, that reads as the only time we truly see Lily as the character she actually is, and not as the construct of Nina's mind.
But That's the other thing as well. It's like, is she scared that she's going to end up like Beth? Is she scared that she's going to be someone who looks to destroy the person that's coming after her? Like, there's a lot of those kind of... And this is the thing, because we never see inside her head, like... And this is a problem with a film like this, where it's, like, unreliable narrators. Like we, like you said, kind of like American Psycho in a way. Mm-hmm. We only ever see things
from Nina's point of view.
Yeah, like Patrick's perspective. Like we never truly know what actually did happen and what didn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, again, what makes that final act. Like, is it defiant or is it triumphant?
And this is why this film is shit.
Like, don't get me wrong. I love this film. I think this, but then again, I'm somebody who loves films like this that are ambiguous, and for this reason, so we can have conversations like this. And I don't think there's any right way or wrong way to interpret the film. I just think that it's very muddled in its messaging, and I think it could get confused in the artistry rather than, like, the audience, you know, experience. But is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Not really.
Seb Stan's got a cameo in this.
Seb Stan's in it. That's about it.
Little weasel mouse.
Okay.
Yeah, so what are your final thoughts on Black Swan, and could you give me a score, please?
I feel like this film thinks it's far more intelligent than it actually is. I think if we've learned anything, directors like Aronofsky are not for me. I find them pretentious and a little bit bullshitty. I don't think Natalie Portman is very good in this. And I just have, like, I'd love to support Natalie Portman, but again, she plays the same character in every fucking film, and whenever she tries to do anything else, it loses any kind of backing.
I thought she was good as Mighty Thor. I will say that. I have a Mighty Thor pop on my side of it.
But
eat my hammer!
Again, no, she's playing the same fucking character. She's a wide, doe-eyed girl who gets powers and, like, continues to be a wide, doe-eyed girl just with magic fucking powers. I think Mila Kunitz is really fucking good in this. I think Vincent Cassell is amazing in this. I will give
that. Because he's a creepy weasel, man.
Fantastic. I love Vincent Cassell. I think he's a great actor.
Yeah. He scares the shit out of me.
I think it's really beautifully shot.
Yeah.
I will give it that. The actual direction of this movie is beautiful. But all in all, I just don't think it's a very good film. I don't think it says anything it actually wants to say, and I think everything it tries to say gets so muddled up that it ends up completely losing what it was saying in the first place.
Again, this is another thing as well. Like, we talk about, give me your score first, but I'll mention it.
I'm going to give it a 2.
Okay.
A 2.
Because this is another thing as well. We talk about Aronofsky contradicting himself quite a lot. This movie, when it came out, have you ever heard of the anime Perfect Blue?
Yes.
Do you know what the anime Perfect Blue is about?
Yes. I've not seen it, but yes.
This movie, basically, a lot of people went, you plagiarised Perfect Blue, didn't you? And he went, no. He said, I don't see any similarities between my work and this work. He was like, even though there's a scene in this where she screams underwater, which is a direct scene taken from Perfect Blue, he's flip-flopped over the 14 years since this movie came out as to, I have seen it, I haven't seen it. Oh, maybe it was a little bit of an influence. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it definitely isn't. And it's like, even when he's being called out for potentially plagiarising work, he can't get his story straight.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of, like, I love Dave, like, I love Darren Aronofsky as a director. I think he's an incredible director. I think some of his work is truly incredible. And he's contributed a lot to cinema. I just think once he's made a movie, he should shut the fuck up. Like,
fair enough.
But yeah, I haven't seen this movie in a long time, and going back and revisiting it made me realise, like, how much I loved it in the first place. Again, the ending being as vague and ambiguous as it is leads to an amazing talking point, but it does lead to a level of audience dissatisfaction, never knowing what the conclusive answer to the question is. And I think, with everything else that happens in the film, a story like this deserves a conclusive ending. Mm. But for that reason, like, obviously I'm not going to give it the full 5 stars that I would have done when I saw this first time. I think I'm going to give it a 4, because I think it has held up incredibly well, and I do think it is one of his better works.
Mm.
But yeah, so that's our thoughts on Black Swan. As always, guys, thank you so much for sticking with us. We will be back on Friday for our Crossing the Stream episode, where we will be looking at The Final Girls. And then we will be back next Monday with a look at one of my very, very, very favourite films, where we will be talking about Richard Kelly's debut film, Donnie Darko. So stay tuned for that. As always, find us on social media, SIMAHFpod on Twitter, So I'm Married a Horror Fan, all lowercase, all one word, on Tumblr and Instagram. If you want to follow us both on Letterboxd, it's Leighton Lawliot for Lee Letterboxd. And for me, it's zombie_Simon. As always, guys, we appreciate everything that you do. And thank you for sticking with us. And we will see you soon. Stay spooky. Stay safe. Take care. Bye-bye.